Hello and welcome to another episode of the 1020 podcast. Today I'm particularly excited because I have the great honor of talking to Bhatia Ungar-Sargon. In 2021, she published her book, Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy, where she deals with the question whether the cultural conflicts in rural America are not in truth class conflicts. It's written very convincingly, and I highly recommend all of my listeners and viewers to get it. You can get it in hardcover on your Kindle or on May 10th, as the audio version read by the author herself. When she's not writing books or op-eds for the New York Times, the Washington Post, Foreign Policy, Newsweek, Spiked, or the UK Daily Mail, she's the deputy opinion editor of Newsweek. She has been seen several times in recent months on CNN, MSNBC, Tucker Carlson, and most recently on Bill Maher, where she explains why an elite that gets ever more detached from the needs of average people is becoming a threat to American democracy. Recording. All right. So the first thing I would really love to talk with you about is, of course, your book, right? I think it came out in October 2021, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, correct.
It came out. It's, by the way, for all our listeners and viewers, you can get it immediately on Kindle. It's currently $1.99. So this is,
Can't beat that.
Right, there's no excuse. There's no excuse not to get it. And which is even more exciting for those who are too lazy to read, I think on May 10th, the audio version should come out, the audiobook, which is read by none other than the author herself, if I'm not mistaken.
You are not mistaken. That is correct.
So, and it's even a better steal. If you buy the Kindle version, you can get, I think, the audio version at a discount. So there is really, there is no excuse for anybody who sees this or watches this. I'll put the link in the description. So I expect these sales to go up immediately after this has gone. This has gone on the air. So let me try. So I'll try to summarize a little bit what your book is about, and correct me if I'm wrong. So the main topic, right, that you engage with is kind of how the media landscape in the United States has changed. And you kind of pinpoint to 2011, where you say, you know, you see that certain terms when within the New York Times and other mainstream media go up, like issues about race, issues about, white supremacy, these topics. But you then make the point that this is kind of where the symptoms become visible. But there was a change going on much earlier. So this is only when it becomes clearer for the observer. And what I find quite interesting, you make the case that it's not so much the issues themselves, but that these issues are, again, now I sound like a hobby psychologist, but it's like it's a coping mechanism for a new elites that emerge within the media to kind of justify their own new membership in an elite class that really doesn't vibe well with what originally the idea of journalism was, right? To being those who speak truth to power, to be the check on the elites. And now they were the elite themselves. So they tried to find a way to justify their elite status by focusing on these issues. And if I would summarize it kind of in a nutshell, so you say that we look at wokeness, if we use that term, as a cultural phenomenon, but you say it's actually more a class phenomenon. It's like it's the surface under which a class conflict is brewing, and we kind of only focus on the symptoms that look like culture, but it's actually a class conflict or a class issue. Would that be, you know, in general, an accurate description?
Yeah, that was amazing. Wow, I can't believe it took me 75,000 words to say what you just said so well.
And I read it, right? I read it.
Yeah, that's completely accurate. Yeah, I mean, I use the not coping mechanism, but, you know, a great distraction, you know, magic trick that allows the people who are benefiting from income inequality to truly believe that they're actually, you know, on the side of the little guy when actually they're protecting their own economic interests. Yep, exactly.
I mean, what I find particularly interesting, so when I read it, I was reminded there was an Austrian economist, Joseph Schumpeter, who wrote a book in 1942 about socialism, capitalism, and democracy. And his theory was more or less, he said, socialism is going to win in the end, but not because it's a superior system. He argued capitalism is so successful in producing goods and services and in producing wealth that we then can afford to create an intellectual class. But that intellectual class is going to be so disappointed with the system because they feel that the system doesn't give to them what they deserve, that they are constantly kind of, you know, making then, they try to rile up the people against the system. And this is a little bit what I also find in your book, right? Exactly this idea that it's this new class that that it, they seem to be, I mean, what motivates them? Could you describe that? So if you maybe describe to us a little bit, what was the change that happened and that then in 2011 started to become obvious?
So actually, it's funny, Alan Bloom makes a similar case that, you know, that the intellectual elites always feel a lot of like resentment towards the super rich, like the top 10% have, unbearable resentment against the top 1% because they believe that the top 1% got that their money through, you know, something crass, wealth, right? You know, capitalism, commerce, whereas they are so smart and intellectual that these are the real talents. How come we're not that rich? And that a lot of this is motivated by resentment. I don't totally buy that because like, look, I'm a former woke. So I remember what it felt like to kind of be in that space. And you truly do feel, contrary to all the evidence, that if any moment you're not talking about race or gender, you are indulging in privilege, right? So it's an escape from a feeling of, you know, fallenness or, you know, in a way of ameliorating intense feelings of guilt. You know, I remember when I was in it and feeling like every breath I take, every benefit I get, every dollar I make, I'm stealing from a person of color, right? Like that's kind of like the mindset. And when you truly believe that, it's very hard to, if you're a good person, which a lot of, I mean, I think most people are, it's very hard not to fall prey to the pressures, especially when the whole media is telling you this, of like obsessing over this issue. At the same time, it is 100% the case that these liberal elites are literally lining their pockets with the proceeds of this obsession. And so I think they are motivated by true feelings of guilt and, you know, the desire to see a more just world. But at the same time, I don't think they would be making such a huge category error if it wasn't very beneficial to them financially. And of course, there's this like Nietzschean will to power underlying all of this. Like, you know, the Democratic Party, all of its power right now comes from having a monopoly on information that benefits elites. It's all elites talking to other elites. It's the top 10% on the liberal side. And so I think it's complex. On the one hand, it is motivated, I think, by genuine feelings of you know, wanting to see a more just world. On the other hand, it's very economically beneficial. What do you think? Because I love hearing other people's analyses of the motivations here. Like, what do you think is motivating this?
I'm feeling put on the spot here. It's a, I don't know. I mean, this is exactly what you said. But I'm wondering, are they self-aware? That was, I think, you know, that has been now this whole debate. And I think we'll come to this as well, right? What's going on with Disney, right? This is what you have in Florida, right? With these laws about parental rights and education. And I forgot what her name is. It's one of the heiresses of Disney. And she went on this long Twitter rant, right? About the horrible conservatives. And it was like, you know, how they need money to push their agenda and all these kind of things. But like, yeah, but isn't that exactly what you are doing as well? So sometimes it's like a mirror image that they accuse others of, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of projection. Yeah,
precisely.
Yeah. You saw this with the truckers in Canada, where, you know, they started calling them fascists and Nazis, like from the get-go. And then they smeared them as fascists and then used that as an excuse to, Justin Trudeau used that as an excuse to enact actually fascist measures against them, right? Like suspending their civil liberties and their right to congregate, arresting, you know, literally political dissidents. Like that projection happens so often. And with Disney, it's just so funny because, you know, only 36% of Democrats are on the side that Disney has now chosen against that bill, which means that, you know, like just 15% of Americans like are opposed to the bill. Disney is now going to make movies for like that 15% of Americans, like the children of these liberal elites who would never be caught dead in a Disney World park, right? Like they hate that stuff. Like they hate anything that's like that the populace, like that their dirty masses love, cruise ships, Disney World, what have you. It's just crazy. And it's such a great question. What is Disney doing? Like they're saying, okay, we're going to be making movies now only for this 15%, by the way, none of whom have children. Like how many of these people have children? Like It's so nuts. And it's such a great question. I think you could see in the hesitation Disney had that they see the numbers. They know that this is a big mistake, and yet they couldn't help themselves. Like the pressures that, you know, they succumb to, that Twitter pressure, that activist pressure, the, you know, AOC pressure. It's like, it's so, I don't know. It's they've painted themselves into a corner.
I mean, it reminds me a little bit, in many ways, you described the situation in the United States, but it reminds me of something that happened in Europe in the 70s and 80s, mm-hmm. which is you had this shift, and it happened similarly to what you describe in the realm of media. So you had in the 60s and 70s, you had all these college graduates, right, who kind of were streaming particularly into left-wing parties. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem was, right, the working class, who usually made up the bulk of these parties, well, they had to work. But all these college graduates, they didn't really have jobs at the time. So, you know, every time there was a party meeting, anytime there was a party vote, the only people there were these college graduates. So, right, they shifted the party always further to the left because the working class was actually working. And then you had this weird, weird gap going up, right, where they said, and now this was particularly true in Germany in the 60s and 70s, they said, we need a revolution and the working class must rise up. And the working class said, well, we want a bigger TV and an additional week's vacation, and otherwise our values are actually pretty conservative. So,
totally.
So what you then saw happening was this, and I think this is a little bit what you see happening, and maybe we talk about this, it was a recent article in the New Yorker, and you write about this as well. It's, they have a picture, in Europe it was a picture of the working class, right? This romanticized picture, so they are in chains and we will break their chains. And I think it's very often similar in the United States, right? I thought this about the discussion about voting ID. And I think, I forgot who it was, but they went then into black neighborhoods and they said, so how difficult is it to get an ID? And they said, it's no problem at all. Or, you know, when they say the black population doesn't know how to use the internet, right? Which is, so they have this they project on them a picture
totally.
Of they are so helpless
totally.
And they need us to save them. And then when they encounter them in real life, they say, wait a moment. They are not that helpless, but this is, instead of saying, oh, this is great, they say, this is even horrible, because that the person you want to save don't need saving. I mean, that's horrible if you want to be a savior, right?
Totally, totally. I mean, it's, you really hit the nail on the head, but I think so much of what, you know, what we're seeing stems from that. I mean, like, if you look even back to the Russian Revolution, you know, like Lenin writes about his disappointment and exactly what you just described, like when he found out and he realized that all the working class wanted were lives that were like a little bit more like the bourgeoisie, right? And so, and you see this throughout the Frankfurt School's writing, you know, Erich Fromm and Horkheimer and Adorno, like how disgusted they became with this. They called it authoritarian. Like they just could not wrap their heads around the fact that these people were conservative socially. They believed in the family structure, you know, they didn't want revolution. They just wanted exactly, like you said, one more week of vacation and a bigger TV. And the disgust that elites have with that, you see that all over the place. And of course today the critical race theory is the predominant paradigm with which our intelligentsia sees the world. And critical race theory came straight out of critical theory, you know, like these black intellectuals, they are so distant from the communities whose lives they draw their credibility from, right? Like their credibility comes from speaking on behalf of the people, the Black community, who we continue to fail to ensure the American dream, who we continue to fail equal rights before the law. So in the name of defending that community, they get a lot of credibility, but then say things that are completely alien in that community, completely alien to the needs of that community, because a lot of Black Americans are middle class and working class. And the number one value to people in those classes is not government handouts and it's not critical race theory, it's autonomy, exactly like you said. And autonomy is totally foreign to the way that intellectuals think about things, because they view things much more in this patronizing way. They view things as, you know, they see that gap, that savior complex, the gap between themselves and their learnedness, right? And then the working class that they claim to speak on behalf of. Totally.
I mean, I'm wondering, like one argument that was made on the optimistic political right, the libertarian right, was sure, these ideas, right, they are in colleges and universities, but once they encounter real life, this will fade away, right? So wokeness is like a fad, a phase you have in university, but real life will kind of hit you real fast. it doesn't seem like this. And because if it would be like this, it would not that be that big a problem, right? It would just be, you know, a period you go through. But isn't this, and you, I think you alluded to this already a little bit, but isn't this doing real harm to those communities that they, I'm sure, well-intended, want to speak of? Like, for example, if you constantly tell, let's say, the African-American community, right, you are not in charge of your life, you have no agency. Like, even if you try hard, you can't make it because, you know, there's the structural suppression, the structural racism. And nobody denies that racism exists. That, like this is, it would be ludicrous to say it's not there. But there's a difference. There's even a difference to say, you're going to have it harder because I'm even willing to accept the idea that there is something to an extent like white privilege. I mean, I'm willing to accept this. But to tell somebody, no matter how hard you try, you never have a chance, then why would these people ever try? And if they don't try, then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. They don't try, so they cannot succeed. And they say, well, look at us. We cannot succeed because you suppress us. But if you look at the numbers, especially with the Black community, right, they were socially very mobile in the 60s, in the 70s. It kind of starts to go downhill even more in modern times.
It's one of the great ironies and tragedies of American life is that the time of greatest upward Black mobility was right before the civil rights era. Paternalism is very bad. It makes the pater feel very good and everybody else just, you know, takes away their agency and their ability to succeed on their own merits. And, you know, what we have in America is what looks like a debate about economics, but really isn't. You have the right with their sort of trickle down. I don't know where you are on the economic question, but to me, it just seems like crap, like just the whole nonsense that has led to the immiseration of the working class. But on the left, what you have is what they are pushing is really a sort of expanded welfare state. You know, this view that comes out of Silicon Valley where it's like, well, you know, increasingly things are going to be automated. There aren't going to be working class jobs. So we're just going to pay people off not to work. We'll give them a universal basic income, let's say, free housing, right? Food stamps. They want the working class to be like the poor, to be living sort of at the beneficence of liberal elites, which of course takes away their political power, right? Because political power is very tied to economic power, very tied to you being in the workforce, to you having a role of building up your nation, autonomy, all of these values that are very intrinsic to the working class. They don't want to live on the dole. They don't want to live at the beneficence of liberal elites. And you know, there's a fundamental tension between the poor and the working class, between their interests, right? There are people who simply can't work. There are people who are mentally ill. There are people who are addicted to drugs. There are people who have been, you know, who as a result of those problems have been in the criminal justice system, who no longer have the capacity to, you know, re-enter society at that level. These are just like sociological facts. We have to take care of those people as a society. But to turn the working class into that, you know what I mean? It's that is so fundamentally at odds with what a democracy is supposed to be about. And what you have in America is, you know, the top 5%, the merchant right, being like, you know, let's immiserate the poor, let's pay them $3 an hour, let's, you know, forget about the working class, they don't care about their own workers. But what you have countering that on the left is, let's turn everybody into the poor and we'll take care of them. And not, no one is speaking to the 50, 60% of Americans who are working class who just want a job that gives them dignity. There's just literally no one is speaking to that point of view. And it's just crazy. Like, they really don't have a voice. Their choices are, you know, the left that insults their culture, insults their values, and gives them nothing, or the right that, you know, gives them nothing, but at least doesn't insult their values and their culture. And so, of course, they've been, you know, and also, I mean, to me, like we started with, so much of what we call cultural battles are actually class warfare. And I think a really good example of this is marriage, because, you know, people don't realize this, but the median income of a Black head of household who's married is $93,000 a year, which is $60,000 a year more than the median income of a Black male head of household who is not married. And $40,000 a year more than the average American, the median white American income. You know, it's to have a platform that devalues marriage, that tells people it's not important, that, you know, to have a welfare system that's tied to not being married. All of these things are, it looks like culture war, you know, it looks like it's about culture, but it's not. It's actually about economics. And we make that mistake a lot because it benefits liberal elites to make that mistake.
There's something I'm curious to hear your take about. It's like a chicken and an egg problem, because I think your arguments are very compelling, right? As I said, I always thought about this in terms of culture, but I think your argument that it's more about classes, it's very well formulated. So I really, in many areas, came around there. But there was one thing I was wondering, which is the divide we see. Could it be that what has changed historically, and that I think we probably almost have to go back 100 years, but that there was a time, I'm glorifying a little bit, so take it with a huge grain of salt, but there was in kind of the idealistic, let's say, form of patriotism, maybe not now, of patriotism, right? Where even if you were economically better off than others, you kind of felt something that tied you to the others because you were Americans, you were Germans, you were French, right? This there were all these differences in class, in behavioral codes, but there was still this feeling of some commonality, and thereby very often almost some form of responsibility of the higher classes for the lower classes, but not to patronize them in a sense, but to kind of uplift them, right? These are, you know, the philanthropic activities, building libraries, building housing for workers. And as I said, I'm glorifying here maybe a little bit inappropriately. And as we became a more individualized society, right, this idea that those who are better off have some responsibility, not just economically, but also morally for those who are worse off, right? And that as we have deconstructed areas in life where people of different economic backgrounds got together, like the churches, like bowling leagues, right? Or if you look at marriage, intermarriage, right? Where, I don't know, where the owner of the company was marrying, you know, the secretary. Now it's CEOs marrying CEOs, and now it's, you know, doctors marrying doctors. You have these intermingling also no longer. Do you think that while I think your analysis is absolutely correct, but is it possible that it's in a certain sense, it was also preceded by this switch in cultural attitudes to some extent?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think that the meritocratic view that, you know, the view that people who get ahead do so based on their talent and their intelligence is the number one view on the left today among liberals, even among leftists. I mean, they really, really do. It's so deeply ingrained in them because they go to these fancy schools, and that has replaced the noblesse oblige that you're describing, to where we used to think, people used to be religious and they used to think, look, God did me a solid. He put me on top. I have a responsibility to everybody else who's maybe not smart enough, maybe not talented in any way, maybe doesn't have this family fortune, right? It was very clear that whatever put people on top, if you're religious, like that was not the result of your own hard work. It was the result of God having smiled upon you, you know, and we've lost that because the meritocratic view very much sees, success in terms of intelligence and talent as a kind of reward, as opposed to a kind of privilege. And people know, they I think that there is like a false consciousness about that, which is why they project that privilege onto race instead of onto class. I agree with you, by the way. Of course, there are forms of white privilege. You know, my experience encountering a police officer is going to just be completely different from a Black person's. But I don't know that that's a problem of whiteness. I think, you know, there are many non-white races, including Jews like me and Asians and even Black immigrants from African countries who actually do have, you know, America is ensuring them the American dream. So I don't know that it's a problem with whiteness. It's a problem with how we specifically treat the descendants of slaves. And I think that that's a very important thing to point out, because when you say the problem is whiteness, you kind of let yourself off the hook from having to change any of the, having to fix any of the problems, because you can't change your race. Whiteness is a thing that exists. And if it's inherently sinful, inherently problematic, and baked into the DNA of America, there's nothing you can do. When the truth of the matter is, there are certain communities that, you know, one specific community that we have failed again and again, and we should be focused on how to fix those problems rather than just pathologizing, you know, one race, is my view.
I mean, wasn't this a little bit the recipe of Donald Trump? I mean, I'm still kind of looking back on 2016. Personally, just as a quick footnote, for me, the election of Donald Trump was a sign that U.S. democracy is alive, not dead. Like, if somebody like that against the entire, you know, both parties
establishment
can win, for me, this is a sign that you know, American democracy is much more energetic than we think. But there was this one thing that he did at a rally. I have to admit, I forget where it was. I think it was in Kentucky, maybe. I don't know. And he was saying, "My God, if I become president, it's going to be horrible because I can never drive a Rolls Royce again." Right? And the crowd was roaring with laughter. Right? And people were saying, "Well, how can they think this is funny?" Right? And he's the arrogance, the millionaire. Right. But it turned out that I cannot say if he was authentic or not. I to some extent, I think he was authentic because you cannot permanently play such a role, I believe. But I can be wrong here. But the thing was, people didn't mind, right, that he was rich and was maybe to add on another thing, right? I always like, he was always wearing the same suit and the same tie. Like, he was not doing what, you know, usually American politicians, and we do the same in Europe. Like, when they go to Ohio and then in the middle of the speech, they take off their jacket and roll up their sleeves and show, because I'm a working class man. Right? It's playing. And people know that, right? The people in Ohio know that. I don't know if I forgot what was his name, was like one other of the Republican candidates, John Casey, mm-hmm. right? No, he started every speech with "as the son of a mailman," right? People know it was a shtick. Mm-hmm. And Trump was Trump. But what he did say is, "But I do take you seriously," right? He said, I'm not one of you, but I potentially am one for you. And I feel that did resonate with people. So, I mean, doesn't that kind of tell us that the working class is not, and I think you described this so nicely in the first chapters and the introduction of your book, right? Instead of engaging with this question, why was he attractive to the working class? It was always the same answer, right? It's a problem of whiteness, and it's racism. And even if people say they're not racist, it's still racism. And it's always the same. But nobody looked at, well, isn't it possible, out of curiosity, right, that this man was speaking to his particular class that they have been ignoring? And I think we still ignore this at our own peril.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, the two predictors for whether a county would go for Trump was how impacted it had been by NAFTA and how many deaths of despair there were, which of course are related. These white working class Americans without a college degree are committing mass suicide and, you know, opioid overdoses and alcoholism and literally suicide in the areas that have been impacted by NAFTA because they don't see a future for themselves in the American economy. And that used to be a left-wing concern. Like, we used to care about those people and now we don't. And then instead of like caring about them, we say, why are they voting against their economic interests? All of this nonsense. And, you know, Thomas Piketty, the French economist, has shown that this really is not just an American phenomenon. I mean, it explains Brexit as well. But what you're describing of that crisscross, where it used to be the left-wing parties were populated by the working class and were very focused on class issues and very suspicious of mass immigration because it came at the workers' expense, right, to import, you know, a working class from another country. And it used to be that the right-wing parties were populated by, you know, only the rich, right, the economic elites, even people who are like socially liberal. Now what you see is the left-wing liberal parties are populated by these sort of highly overeducated liberal elites who are obsessed with climate change. And the right-wing parties are populated by the poor and the working class. And their number one issue is immigration and border control, because that is about jobs. That is about economic anxiety. And the liberal media refuses to see this because it implicates them, right? They know exactly what side they're on and they know exactly what they're obsessed with. And so, you know, how easy it was in the case of Brexit, in the case of Trump, to just smear everybody as racist, to avoid talking about the truth, which is there is massive inequality and the talkers have benefited from it and they don't want to talk about that.
I mean, this is something I also wanted to ask your take on, because you talked about this already last year and you mentioned it also on Bill Maher when you were on his show. And I think this is such an important point. The independently of what one thinks of climate change, I mean, I guess we can all agree, yes, something is happening with the climate. So neither you nor I, we're not climate change deniers. But I think it is important to look at the policies that are recommended, because they impact people differently. And this, I feel, is again, it's a particularly an issue that's important for the elites, but a lot of the costs are kind of rolled over on the working class. And I feel this got worse in as a consequence of the pandemic. I mean, if you look at my job, right, I work at a university, or your job, we do something that allows us to work from home, right? It allows us to, you know, kind of be part of the laptop class. And I guess we're lucky enough to have a certain level of income that this position gives us. But now you have this absurd situation that we can work from home, which means we probably don't need a car, right? So we don't need to fill up our gas tank. We're still going to get whatever our monthly paycheck is. But the guy who is facility management, the guy who, you know, is at the front desk, in our case, at the university or, you know, at the fancy hotel, they need to get into the car and drive to work. They need to fill up their gas tank, right? So it's not just that they generally have a lower income. It's also now that they have higher costs to do their jobs. And somehow, and this is something that drives me also crazy in Europe, right? When it says, you know, the environment, and it's now similar with the Ukraine and energy embargoes. You say, well, this is a price we must be willing to pay. And I'm wondering, who exactly is that we that they're all talking about?
Totally. It's so disgusting. It's so disgusting. And, you know, it's very, very Calvinist in nature, because the elites have mistaken this gift from God, you know, like their economic privilege, for proof of their virtue. That's what's happening here. And so anybody who's poor or who's working class is now cast as a moral pervert for not having the economic benefit that is, like, you know, God given. I'm sorry, I'm religious. It's like, that's how I see it. But it's like, you didn't do anything to deserve this. Even if it's the result of your intelligence, who made you smart? Like, you didn't make yourself smart. You think you work harder than the truck driver who brings all of the food that you eat to your doorstep? Give me your break. Like, the entire COVID conversation was about class. It was about rich liberals sitting at home on their laptops, tweeting out, you know, stay home, slow the spread, casting all of the people that they rely on to feed them and to bring them food as morally perverted. And it's exactly the same thing with the climate change stuff. Like, yes, of course, the climate is getting warmer. Yes, of course, we should be taking steps to mitigate that. But every step we take benefits the elites and comes at the expense of the working class, the people who can least afford it. And so you have situations where John Kerry, the climate czar, literally flew on a private jet to accept a climate award. And when they asked him why, he was like, this is the only way people like me in my class can travel and do the things we need to do. It's like, come on. They have now in California what's called Green Jim Crow. There's a new kind of redlining happening to where Black and Hispanic Californians are spending between 10 and 20% of their income on electricity costs because they've made electricity so expensive. Of course, if you're a billionaire, you get yourself some solar panels on your, you know, mansion, right? And you're not going to end up paying those costs. And it's just, it's very, very, it's crazy. I mean, it's just crazy to me. You look at what AOC is touting, and it's Green New Deal, which would replace good union energy jobs that give working class Americans a middle class standard of living with, you know, minimum wage, low skill labor, windmills we're importing from China, right? And the other thing they're pushing now is student loan forgiveness. I mean, this is all about class. Who benefits from student loan forgiveness? Dentists, accountants. We're going to have working class people, we're going to have linemen and factory workers paying off the student loans of doctors. It's just so appalling. And, you know, I feel crazy because nobody can see it. You say this stuff and they're just like, no, there are people who dropped out of college who have student loans, who have, you know, don't even have an associate's degree. It's like, I'm all for paying off their loans. That's not what you're asking me to do. You're asking me to pay off your loans. Like Mr. Film Studies major who works at the New York Times, you know, and you feel nuts because it's like, there's so few people who are actually making these points, especially on the left.
I mean, Karl Marx once said that the big problem for the working class is that they at the beginning lack the skills to organize themselves. Do you think that's still true? Kind of that there is an anger, but yet, not yet some a way to channel that anger into political power?
I think that there was a handshake agreement between Democrats and Republicans to create a free market economy that is like basically close to a libertarian's fantasy. And there's just, I mean, how can any individual worker, how can even a group of workers organize against a corporation like Amazon? Actually, you did see that just happen, you know, in Staten Island. But interestingly, that was, you know, a very like grassroots local thing. It was not in participation with national unions, even though the national unions had tried, you know, to and keep failing at Amazon. And so that I do think that's kind of a one-off. I think that a lot of the, it's interesting also because at Starbucks, a lot of Starbucks workers are college educated. And so you're seeing them, and they don't really need that job. I mean, once you have a college degree in America, you're much more economically mobile. And so what you have is this ironic situation to where the people who least need these jobs are the most able to have the luxury of organizing a union, if I could say it like that, because of course everybody needs unions, and yet unions are really, the national unions are really failing because they become extremely woke and working class Americans don't see themselves reflected in them. But I just think that the power is just against them. You know, Amazon and Starbucks workers in Sweden, in Germany, in France, they get paid $20-$25 an hour because those corporations have to deal with unions in those countries. And it's really devastating to see. It's just how much power corporations have. And again, you have this situation where the corporations went woke, which got the left off their backs. And so you have the right sort of saying, oh, they've gone woke, like, you know, they're opposed to their wokeness, but they don't care at all that they're robbing their workers blind and that productivity, you know, American productivity is like this and American wages are like this, right? That decoupling is just disgusting. So I don't know if it's about skills so much as just like, you know, or you'll try to unionize and then you'll have the, they'll just shut down the branch. Like, what are they? Starbucks doesn't need, you know, that branch. It's going to cost them more if they're unionized. They'll just shut down the branch. You know, you have situations like that. And I think also another part of it is Americans are very entrepreneurial in nature. They don't want to be in a combative relationship with management. I mean, I think that it's a very meritocratic society. People like to feel like they're going to go to work and have a good relationship with management and be rewarded for good work. They don't like that feeling of adversarial relationship with management. I think that's another big part of it. And it's so interesting because I was talking to the leader of a very big union and he told me that they oppose paid leave. They don't push for paid leave. I said, why is that? And he said, because my workers want to be paid and paid well for every minute of work they do and not 1 minute more. And that is a very working class point of view that is, again, totally alien to the, you know, the clerisy that's always pushing for, you know, the whole Build Back Better was like environmentalism, student loan forgiveness, and things like paid leave. That a lot of working class people, some working class people do want that. They do. They want to be able to take care of their kids. They want to know that their job is safe. But a lot of them are like, why would I get paid if I didn't go to work? And it's just, there's that cultural disconnect.
Is it possible? So I was wondering about this. I was again, when I read your book, and I was thinking about this over the last couple of days, that we made one, like in the West, as Western societies, that we made one big miscalculation over the last couple of years, which is the idea was, right, and you mentioned this a little bit. So we had globalization, kind of, you know, we were outsourcing our production. And overall, right, kind of as an economist would say, in general, right, this worked quite well. Prices were going down, right? We can buy amazing goods, especially goods and also services at very low prices. Fantastic. And a little bit of an argument was, that was also made by economists was, sure, this will be a hit for the working class, but we're going to earn enough. Overall, productivity will go up to such an extent that we, quote unquote, can pay off the working class. But they might then sit at home, but they're not going to starve because we have the means to do so. And maybe we got it all wrong. That the core of, without sounding too dramatic, but that the core of human existence is not just to consume as much as possible, but to contribute through labor, through work to society. And that may be, and this is an argument that people like Tucker Carlson make. And I think he's not entirely wrong. I might would make it differently than he would, but I think he's onto something to say, well, if we get, let's say, a factory back from China, yes, these goods and services will become more expensive. But maybe, you know, paying for your cell phone $150 instead of $50 does also mean that you have a huge group of people that now are not going to fall into, you know, drug addiction, alcoholism, you know, or simply retreat from society, you know, obesity, diabetes, you know, the metaverse, all these kind of things, because they do something productive, they work. And that this might be a price, as they say always, that this might be a price worth paying. But we probably then would have to change our mindset to say, we actually don't just want people to get a paycheck or to get government money. We want them to have meaning. That's also important, I think. We want them to have meaningful work. It might mean that prices go up. It might mean some inflation. But maybe what it brings in sense of psychological health of society is worth it. And I was wondering what you would think about this.
I 100% agree with that. I think that elites think about the economy in terms of trade because they like buying things because they have disposable income. And I think working class people think about the economy in terms of jobs because you get meaning from your job. We freaking know that. Like, we are so addicted to our jobs. Like, you know what I mean? That whole meritocratic rise, the credentialism, you know, we all left our little towns and moved to New York because we're obsessed with our jobs. And we're telling them, stay home. Don't worry, you'll have enough to eat and you'll have a nice iPhone. Give me a break. It's disgusting. Like, that gap. And the thing of imposing on working class Americans, imposing on Black Americans, a standard you would never in a million years accept for yourself or your own children. That is like the bread and butter of the Democratic Party and the leftist elites today. And it is so gross. I totally agree with you. You get money from having work. And it's so funny. Elizabeth Warren wrote a book called The Two Income Trap, about how important it is to be able to sustain a family on one income. That's the American dream. And of course, the feminist says she could never say that now because the feminist would go crazy. No, the American dream is for, you know, women to be in the workforce, like working 16-hour days, coming home to their kids exhausted, you know, paying the nanny, who's obviously an illegal immigrant who they're paying under the table, right? Like, that's the American dream, right? And I just think that it's so gross. I completely agree with everything you just said. Bring those factories back. The people who are going to be, who are, you know, benefiting from mass immigration, benefiting from these trade deals, they'll be able to afford the price difference, you know, and everybody else will have dignity.
But there's one other thing. It's a little bit, I digressed a little bit, but I think it's something that I'm always wondering, because like every society, there always have been ideological battles and class tensions and so. But what I always liked, especially about the Anglo-Saxon experience, I always feel this becomes less the case the more you move to the East, was that they had a certain sense of humor, right? There was an optimism. Well, I guess the Americans would call it pragmatism. In the British case, I call it more optimism. Right, everything becomes much darker the further you go to the East. Right, and as you said, in Germany, then you have the Nietzsches, and then you move right into Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. So it always gets more pessimistic the further you move to the East. But I feel that is getting lost too. Right, it's very hard these days to make a joke. And I know one might think, well, what does this have to do with anything? Well, it's like you can, it's so hard to have, if everybody is, you know, having a stick down their back or whatever expression you want to use, it's hard to have a conversation. It feels like, and this is kind of what I'm trying to get at, there was one, and this is, I don't know how to put it. On the one hand, modernity gave us tremendous individualism, and it's great, right? You can be whoever you want to be. I think this is awesome, right? You have, you know, you can pick from, and I don't mean this fascistically, it's a difficult word. You know, you can be one of 65 different genders. So they're all awesome, right? This is great. But it also, it led to a form of thin-skinned individual isolation. And if you cut off all the bridges between individuals, right? If you really throw, kind of as Alexis de Tocqueville wrote, right? You throw them back on themselves, and all these things that played a role in tying us together. You know, we watched movies and we laughed together. We get the same jokes, like sports. Another thing, like sports. You enjoyed sports. I mean, I lived in Kentucky for a long time, right? And you could go into a bar and talk about the Kentucky Wildcats, you know, with the guy in the suit and the guy in the overall, and because we all agreed that this is our team. But now sports has become politicized. Comedy has become politicized, and it's no longer funny as well. So do you think that makes this is even worse in a sense?
Yes, in a word.
Okay.
No, I can't disagree with anything you said. I totally agree with you. It's just so sad. And the people who most need humor, Yiannis Pappas made this point when I was on his show. He's a comedian, and he said, the people who most need humor are the people whose lives are terrible, you know, like working class people, like poor people. And they're the ones who are being like cut, you know, the people destroying humor are the elites who are rich, who are fine, who are, you know, totally economically privileged, who are going to be fine no matter what. And they're taking away humor from the people who most need it. It's really, really sad. And yeah, I mean, I can hear it in your commentary. I think you probably sounds like you were as influenced as I was by Bowling Alone, you know, that amazing book about the destruction of, you know, societies and social capital in America, to where we used to meet in church and synagogue and clubs and bowling, you know, to meet with Americans that we disagreed with and remember like what it felt like to respect people that you don't agree with and hear their point of view. And, you know, we really have lost a lot of that texture, that social texture. And, you know, there's a debate, I think, a lot of people have noticed this on the right, and they use it as an excuse to say, look, the real problem, the real breakdown of the community is not about economics. It's about these other social concerns. But I think they're so clearly related. You know, the, like, you know, the people committing suicide and deaths of despair are men without a college degree. Like, that's obviously connected to a crisis in masculinity, which is like obviously connected to like offshoring of their jobs and the fact that, you know, in so many cities, women now make more than men. And, you know, there's, it's just like the family structure, being able to provide for your family, all these things that give people dignity. You know, we really, there's sort of a real crisis brewing, and a lot of it is made because the two sides are both only speaking the elites of each side to each other and fighting and making it look like there's this robust debate when actually there really isn't, because this fight benefits both sides equally economically.
I mean, let me try an almost anti-American suggestion, or something that probably will, the American listeners will hate this idea. But do you think that the state could play a role in helping out with this? For example, I'm thinking about, it doesn't have to be military service, but some form of social service, I know, maybe, you know, in a form of a gap year or something, where you bring people from different backgrounds, from different classes together, and they work on a common project. I mean, many studies have been done about the situation in Israel, right? And it turns out that in Israel, for example, the military is not just important from a security standpoint, but it also plays a role in, you know, forging and you know, society together beyond you know, cultural, ethnic. I mean, Israel is also a very diverse nation, just like the United States. But that you find something to tie these people together. And I know, I guess, for the libertarian American to hear the idea of a mandatory service is probably the biggest nightmare imaginable. But do you think this is something that we should at least entertain as a resolution for this growing gap, that at some point, in the worst case, this can tear a country apart?
I don't think our problem is one of social cohesion, because I think when you get out of these circles where the elites live, the polarization just evaporates. I mean, working class Americans are not politically polarized. They work side by side, Trump voter, anti-Trump. They don't care. They don't care at all. So to me, the problem is not social cohesion. To me, like, what we should be investing in is, you know, what Germany has, which is a vocational school, regional bargaining, all of these like very obvious things. Like, what we need in America is high-skilled laborers. There's never going to be a shortage for that. And what we're doing now is importing them from other countries and building up the middle class in other countries. I don't know why we're doing that. And I think it's because liberals, very much together with conservatives, created an economy that works really well if you are smart, and very poorly if you work with your hands, if you make the things we eat, if you move the things that we need, if you build the things that we live in, if you do any of the jobs that a society actually needs. Our society does not value that anymore. And I think that the way to heal a lot of what divides us is to force rich people to reckon with the power of the working class again. And the way you do that is by building them up economically. And the way to do that is just like so simple, like regional bargaining, unions, vocational training. Like, it's just so, you know what I mean? It just seems so obvious, and like, no, neither side is invested in it because neither side actually cares, and neither side wants a threat to their monopoly.
Do you think it's also kind of part of the story is also the Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff have worked a lot on these issues. that family structure has changed in a way, right? The families, I know the family formation is later, which very often has economic reasons, because it's just you need to have a certain age to have enough income to afford a family. They are smaller, right? Maybe one children, maybe two children. And then these children are so precious, which is understandable, that the parents attempt kind of to shield them from all kinds of, you know, whatever problems might life would throw at them. And this is then how you end up at these, on the one hand, over-credentialed class, right? Because parents from, you know, from kindergarten age will start to attempt to, you know, you get into the best kindergarten and the best preschool and the best high school, and then you go to Harvard or Princeton or Yale, and kind of your path is laid out, and every obstacle, they bulldoze preemptively every obstacle out of the way. And then you have, I don't want to use the term snowflake because it's a bit demeaning, but it's fragile. It's not as, you know, it's not anti-fragile. Kind of you then end up with a much more fragile society, which also bleeds into the universities. I mean, as you probably know as well, we no longer grade at universities. We no longer demand at universities what we demanded, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, like with grade inflation and all these kind of things. So that even though on paper, yeah, our societies seem smarter, but as kind of put it as a provocative question, are we really smarter, or does it kind of, do we just have the paper to show we are?
That's really interesting. You're like, this credential means so much less than it did back in the day because you didn't actually have to learn anything to get it. Yeah, it's all about social climbing. It's all about, like, you know, does a dentist really need to learn physics? No, they will never use physics in their lives. It's just about gatekeeping the elites. And I do, you know, you have this situation where you, exactly like you said, you'll have some couple living in Park Slope and their combined income is $400,000 a year, and they feel poor and they actually don't have a lot of, you know, disposable income because their kids are in private schools. They have two kids. They're both in private school, which costs each one $50,000 a year. And, you know, and they have to pay for the tutors and the extracurricular to get them into, to make sure that they get into the next stage. And like all of that is about, but to me, all of that stems from the pressures. The pressures are real because there are very few slots at the top. It is the top 10%, and you have to work really hard to get in there. And so it's both this rat race where they do end up making a lot of money, but that doesn't, they don't have any time to enjoy it because there's, and, but that stems from what we did, which was devaluing anything aside from the kind of job that you get. If you go to Princeton, Yale, University of Chicago, UC Berkeley, like you get into that like managerial class, right? The professional managerial class, like, and nothing else matters and nothing else can, you could never imagine one of these Park Slope people being proud of their kid becoming a plumber. It would never in a million years happen. There's only one kind of, you know, way to be. And it's increasingly small. And the pathway to get there is increasingly small. So one of the fair critiques of my book is that I keep talking about these people like they're, you know, fat cats or whatever, when actually they're super stressed out because, you know, think about, let's say, a Gen Xer at the New York Times, right? Who knows? I mean, someone actually said this to me, an editor there. You know that the generation coming up below you, not only do they have superior skills to you, digitally, right, which immediately makes you more exposed, more disposable, but they're also liable to call you racist, right? And then you think about this guy, he's got a mortgage, he's got three kids in private school, and you know, he's paying a mortgage in Montclair or whatever it is. And you know, that's not something that you can, you know, that's not a situation where these people are going to risk anything. And I can't tell you, I had this editor that I used to work with a lot, I'm not going to say where, but increasingly he outpitched something and he'll say to me, look, I'm a white guy in my 50s. You know, I'm not, it's for me to run this would be to stake my career on it. And like, I love you, Baya. It's a great piece, but it's not that good, you know? And like, what am I supposed to say that? Of course, I don't want him to stake his career on some piece that I wrote, but that's sort of the climate where it's like, everybody knows they're expendable. You know, I know another guy who's a really talented journalist who's been trying to get a job, and it's happened to him now four times that they've hired a person of color who's not qualified for the job and then asked him, having not given him the job, to train them because they don't have the skills to do it. And, you know, I'm not saying that there's some sort of like, you know, whatever, like that there's, I'm not, it's, this isn't even about reverse racism. You know, I don't, I'm not, I'm sort of ambivalent about whether that exists or not. I totally hear the arguments on both sides of it, but, you know, just coming back to the fact that like the pressures of belonging to that elite are very, very high. And, but all of the sociological phenomena that we're viewing now, they really do come back to that. But again, it's like, how much sympathy can you have for somebody who makes $400,000 a year combined income and still feels poor? Like, I believe that they feel poor, But like so much of the discourse on the left is about that person's feelings, as opposed to the person who makes $35,000 a year and doesn't have health insurance. And like their kids are downwardly mobile, you know, their sister and their brother are homeless and addicted to opioids, right? And like they're struggling to just make ends meet, you know, to just keep gas in that car, right?
And isn't that a little bit, so what you just described also, I mean, doesn't this also take away from authenticity? This surprised me so much, because one of the topics that I have to admit early on was discarding, and I'm growing more and more fond of, that was important on the left, was the concept of authenticity. I mean, it's still there to some extent, right? I mean, I think a lot of the gender debate goes about this. What is your authentic self? Who are you authentically? But isn't this also what you described, right? If then my goal is, for example, you know, I need to fill my resume with all kinds, let's say, of social activities in order then, you know, to have extracurriculars, to get into that school, to get this. But don't you, to some extent, then devalue those activities, right? They all become means to an end. They are no longer a value in themselves. So I work in a soup kitchen, but not because I care about the people, I want to engage with the people, because I can then put in my little resume, worked in the soup kitchen. And then I can impress a Harvard recruiter. And don't that kind of, you know, kind of, we live in a society where authentic experience becomes ever harder to attain. And that must be a psychological pressure. That must be psychological stress on many people.
My initial response was like, I'm like, okay, well, why do I volunteer? And I'm like, well, because I've read the Bible and God is very zealous and very vengeful. And if you don't do what he says, it gets ugly. Like, is that any more authentic? Like, I don't think I don't know that that's more authentic, like the sort of the good reasons to do things. I mean, I'm overstating a little bit. Obviously I don't take the Bible seriously or literally, but take it seriously, but not literally. I think, you know, I'm not sure that, you know, doing things because, like, I don't know that authenticity is important, but I hear the point that you're making, that there's this kind of like, there's this almost surreal situation where they're being asked to, where they spend their childhood manufacturing experience and knowledge in the service of becoming a cog in a machine or getting through, like, but you know what I mean? I hear what you're saying. I think that irony is definitely thick. Yeah. Yeah.
This is my last question. I'm just very curious about your take on this. I mean, I thought that sometimes one thing that both the left and the right, more in one way or another, very often shared in common is a look back at the past and sometimes an idealizing of the past, but in different ways.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, so is it a little bit, and I was always like, The Deirdre McCloskey, right, the economic mm-hmm. historian, right? She wrote this several volumes about bourgeois society, and she's like, which I think, frankly, she's a huge fan of the bourgeois society, which I am too. And she says, right, this idea that modern capitalist society makes you lonely or this is not true, and then she kind of lists. It's a very, very well done work. It says, look at all these options you have in modern society, all the, you know, all the clubs you can join, all the associations you can be part of. You can travel, you can connect with people via the internet thing, and that. It's all true, but I'm wondering, isn't that a little bit what actually causes the unease, right? If I have so many options, if there's, you know, it's like standing in front of the cereal shelf in the supermarket. You at some point you say, you know what, I stop eating cereal because I cannot pick one from 200 different brands. You'd probably be much more comfortable with, you know, three brands. And couldn't it be similar in a, I don't think it ever was this ideal, but I feel this is what people then look back at when they say before capitalism, right? Life was poorer, but it was structured, it was organized, right? And the same, you know, in the conservative circles, right? The golden times, you know, the areas of the founding fathers, right? Where we kind of, life was, you didn't have these options and it was more structured, and that we kind of long a little bit for this kind of structure. We are overwhelmed, we're almost overwhelmed with the freedom that we have. But maybe this is why there's a little bit of a backlash against it. I'm not expressing myself perfectly, but.
No, I hear what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, I can't be too nostalgic for a time when like gay people or trans people had to live in, you know, religious communities and had no option and had to live in the closet, like, or, you know, the way we treated Black people continue to, but, you know, as recently as 40 years ago, 50 years ago, like, it, to me, it's, you know, I can't be too nostalgic for times like that. But at the same time, I thought you were going to say something I've noticed as well, like the left does romanticize the 70s, because that was the end of sort of economic and social growth and mobility for the working class. And I think it's correct to look fondly back and say, how can we recapture that growth? But if anybody on the right says, you know, things used to be better, they're accused of being racist, right? It's very funny, like only certain kinds of nostalgia are allowed and only for certain things. And again, I think that those things are so wrapped up together. Like, you know, when a conservative looks back to the 50s, what he is most likely feeling nostalgic about is not, you know, segregation. It's the fact that a man could support his family and get dignity from that. And they had social mobility and not that much divided the working class from the middle class, and the middle class even from the rich. Everyone drove the same cars and ate the same food and drank the same, you know, wine and whatever it was. And I think that does come back to choice. Like, we are overwhelmed by choice. And I think that, you know, thinking about like I mean, it goes back to Locke, but like thinking back about like the centrality of like choice, consent, like, you know, freedom as being like the rubrics, the building blocks of liberalism, there is a limit to that, as opposed to kind of the more conservative version of like your, you know, obligation. You know, you have an obligation to yourself, to your family, to your community, to your nation. And without that sense of obligation, I think you really have seen, you know, there is no sense that, you know, among leftists that anything connects them to the Trump voter, that anything connects them to the nation as such. I mean, they really, there does seem to be, to me, often the use of the Black Lives Matter concept, which is an important one, but to devalue the idea of the body politic, the idea of America, to the degree that they no longer have any obligations towards it, which again comes back to economics. It gives you that economic freedom, that travel, that cosmopolitan point of view, which brings something important to the nation, but also can be very destructive. But I would just say, like, I think that this is a tiny minority. I mean, progressives are 6% of Americans, and they are the whitest and the most highly educated and the most affluent of the Democratic subgroups. They're a teeny tiny minority that has a lock on the culture. But I think, you know, what you saw with Glenn Youngkin winning in Virginia, and what you're about to see with this huge red wave, is the opposite of what the primary system would predict. Like, you would think that always with primaries, you're going to get the most extreme on either side, right? Because the person running against somebody in his own party can always be outflanked to the left or to the right. But I think what we're seeing for the first time in my life, it seems to me that Americans are getting more conservative or more moderate. Like, my whole life, I saw the left winning all these really important culture wars, like really important ones about equality, civil rights, whatever. The right completely has now bought all of those ideas there's no partisan divide anymore over equality, over the evils of racism, over the need for police reform, equality for women, all of this stuff. The left won all those cultural battles, and now they're overreaching and moving the goalpost to maintain their power. And I think Americans are turning away from that, again, in a good way, like they're moderating. And I think you're going to see that in 2022 during the midterms. And I think that's really interesting. And to me, that speaks really well of the American people. And it makes me feel optimistic for the future.
If you grant me two more minutes, there's just one very last question I'm curious about. Because in general, I find the ideas of liberalism compelling. I like the idea of individual autonomy. I like the idea of, you know, expressing yourself in whatever ways. I find this this very compelling. But I think one condition very often for liberalism to work was you need then to grant it to everyone, right? You then need to leave other people alone. If we think about, you know, the famous, you know, bakery case, right? If a baker doesn't want to make a cake for a gay wedding, right, I might disagree with this decision. But if that's for them important for their religious belief, right, you would say that's unfortunate, but maybe, right, the gay couple can find another baker. Again, doesn't mean that we approve, but it's kind of, as we said many times today, this would be a price to pay, so to speak, for you know, equally somewhat applied liberalism. But as it became more a form of ideologically and kind of almost imperialistic liberalism, what I fear now, and I'm not sure where I stand on this, so this is why I'm so curious about your position, there is now a counter movement on the right as well, right? Kind of the post-liberal movement. And they have some very, very compelling, very interesting thinkers. But there's then this idea that if the kind of the left-leaning liberalism see it as justifiable, that the state is used as a tool to impose their version of a common good on society, then the right should do the same, right? Then we should come up, from their perspective, we should create our version of the common good, and then we do the same, which I find interesting. But as you said also, right, I find always, kind of, we always look in, when we look back at history, I think the interesting part is always, what was the trend? Right? It's kind of this, I never understood in the discussion about America. America has, like so many countries, of course, conducted great evils and great sins. But the trend, I think, was always in the right direction, right? From the founding, there was always a push in the right direction. So if you take just, 1776, many bad things were present at the time, but the trend was in the right direction. So what I'm worried about now is that maybe the trend is going in a different direction, where you have two sides, and they both, and maybe I'm exaggerating this, and they both agree, if we get to power, we're going to push our vision down your throat. And then it's kind of the American people then can decide if they vote, for a left-wing king or a right-wing king, but whoever's going to be it, right, they no longer will protect the individual liberty to do as they please. They will then be used to shove down whatever vision down the people's throat.
The difference is that the left is college educated, and so there's a market for their intellectuals, and the right is not college educated, and so this right-wing anti-liberal intelligentsia is completely irrelevant. The only way they can impact anything is by getting somebody to get to somebody to get to somebody who knows Trump or DeSantis, because those guys are not intellectuals and they're not interested in intellectual pursuits. They don't need an intelligentsia to justify what they want to do. So to me, this right-wing, I know exactly who you're talking about. I think it's just so elitist and irrelevant. It's not elitist. I mean, it's just completely irrelevant. Like, they have no connection to the actual lived experiences of working class Americans who are completely not interested in any of that. It's just so alien and foreign to the culture. The reason that the liberal nonsense, the illiberalism of the liberals has gotten purchased is because the media, which is made up of college educated people who all studied critical race theory, brought it into newsrooms and used their generational clout to force, their Gen Z and boomer elders to take the knee to them. But Americans are turning against that too, right? Because it's just totally, but so I think the idea that those are equal, like the liberalism on the left and on the right, even in influence, I think is not the case, just because you're right. A lot of the right intelligentsia is coalescing around some of these ideas. Somebody who I do think has purchased is Yoram Chazoni, because his ideas are very commonsensical. And he's basically saying, look, it's important to have a body politic that you feel an obligation to. Like, that's it. It's important to have national borders. It's important to feel something for your fellow Americans. That is very commonsensical. But when it starts to veer into illiberalism, that I think that stuff is just it's so out there. And I just don't see how they get any purchase, because the people they're appealing to are not intellectuals, and they don't think about those things. I think that like you, I agree, the American people is like inherently trending in the right direction. The moral arc of the universe is trending towards justice. I think there's never been a time where more Americans have been bought into Dr. King's vision. Like, we're really headed in the right direction on that front. And I think that Americans know that, and that's where the power comes from to resist the crazy on both sides.
Well, unfortunately, we have to stop here. We had such a highbrow conversation. We didn't even talk about Hunter Biden's laptop or Elon Musk buying 9% of Twitter. So, I just can only say this definitely cannot have been our last conversation.
No.
I have a million questions. We made it to five. This is not going to, it can't end yet. Thank you so much. This was fantastic.
And thank you.
There is, of course, one last question. Any new book projects? Any new book plans?
Maybe. I think I've had an idea. So it's still in its infancy, but I might have something soon.
Good. I hope we will. Thank you so much. I wish you a pleasant rest of the day, and send you the done thing when it's done. But I think this was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Bye.